Warning, Radio Eco Shock is not suitable for all listeners. For anyone suffering from depression, cynicism, skepticism, or despair, use your own discretion.
Side effects may include nausea, paranoia, running away, and persistent hiding. Consult your local representative if you should feel an urge for activism. That is a bit of Sea Lion Woman by the new Canadian superstar Feist. It's the kind of music that keeps me inspired. We'll play the whole song at the end of this edition of the Radio EcoShock Show. Hello again, I am your host, Alex Smith. In this program, we'll experience a wave of world-shaking news, just another week, on the edge of a tumbling civilization. And if the lights go out, from England we have Nick Rosen, the voice of off-grid living. He says crowds of people are leaving the power matrix voluntarily. Are they early adapters for those who fall off the consumer Ferris wheel? This year alone, 2 million American families will lose their homes due to foreclosure. Some of them are already living in campers and cars. We'll investigate the developing phenomenon, the half-homeless, the mobile homelessness. We offer solid tips for living in your car, and you might need them even if your job is solid now. Think earthquake, hurricane, terrorist attack, or just layoffs. Your car may be the answer, but do you know how? Radio for troubled times. Let's go. A survey published by the University of Maryland found that people around the world think oil is running out. The majority of people polled in 15 nations want their governments to find new energy to replace oil. Stephen Cole, the director of worldpublicopinion.org, said, quote, "The widespread consensus that oil needs to be replaced as an energy source may be prompted by concerns about the effect of oil on climate change, as well as the belief that oil will run out," end quote. Only in Nigeria, one of the world's big producers, are people confident in the future of oil. In most countries polled, places like China, India, Egypt, Britain, and South Korea, the majority think their government knows oil is running out and that prices will be much higher. The majority of Americans think we are at or past peak oil, but Americans think their government is acting on incorrect assumptions about our energy future. The Bush government is forging ahead with its plan for 15 billion gallons or more of ethanol by 2015. Everyone went for the food-to-fuel option, including the Europeans. Now we find out that biofuels likely add to global warming rather than helping the climate, and experts predict millions of people will die of starvation just to keep the hungry gas tanks full. We'll get to the startling and painful news about the world food crisis in just a minute. First, we need to expose the myth that so-called green fuels really work. Years ago, environmentalists were saying, we can divert some agricultural waste into a useful energy source, maybe even some municipal waste. It was intended as a minor part, a wedge, one of the many ways we could stay mobile without emitting new carbon from underground sources. Along come the politicians and the lobby groups. They steer billions of dollars into subsidies into the Republican-dominated farm states. Now they're going to stop exporting corn and even wheat, turn it all into fuel for SUVs, and less money to the Arabs or Hugo Chavez. It's a George Bush ethanol nightmare from the man who fights off fuel-efficient cars. Let them drive giants, he says, and let the poor line up for aid that doesn't come. When it doesn't work, well, you can blame the Greens. Brilliant. Good old Lester Brown, who really knows food issues, reports, quote, "Here in the United States, farmers are pulling land out of the federal conservation program, threatening fragile habitats. Increased agricultural production also means increased fertilizer use." The National Academy of Sciences reported last month that meeting the congressional food-to-fuel mandate by 2022 would lead to a 10 to 19% increase in the size of the Gulf of Mexico's dead zone, an area so polluted by fertilizer runoff that no aquatic life can survive there. Most troubling, though, writes Brown, is that the higher food prices caused in large part by food-to-fuel mandates creates incentives for global deforestation, including in the Amazon basin. As Time magazine reported this month, huge swaths of forest are being cleared for agricultural development. The result is devastating. We lose an ecological treasure and critical habitat for endangered species, as well as the world's largest carbon sink. And when the forests are cleared and the land plowed for farming, the carbon that has been sequestered in the plants and the soil is released. Princeton scholar Tom Searchinger has modeled this impact and reports in Science magazine that the net impact of the food-to-fuel push will be an increase in global carbon emissions, and thus a catalyst for climate change. Meanwhile, the mandates are not reducing our dependence on foreign oil. Last year, the United States burned about a quarter of its national corn supply as fuel, and this led to only a 1% reduction in the country's oil consumption. That's the end of a quote from Lester Brown. Keep up to date with Lester Brown and the world food scene at www.earth-policy.org. That's earth-policy.org. You can find The Science of Biofuels and Global Warming in the journal Science, published February 29, 2008, Volume 319. The paper is titled, Use of U.S. Croplands for Biofuels Increases Greenhouse Gases Through Emissions from Land Use Change. It's by Timothy Searchinger and his team. The summary says, quote, by using a worldwide agricultural model to estimate emissions from land use change, we found that corn-based ethanol, instead of producing a 20% savings, nearly doubles greenhouse emissions over 30 years, and increases greenhouse gases for 167 years. Biofuels from switchgrass, if grown on U.S. corn lands, increases emissions by 50%. End quote. It's the same old story. A little bit of biofuels could be helpful, but humans never stop at a little bit. We have to take it all, and we'll kill anything, including the earth, to do it, so it seems. Count biofuels out for now. Oh yeah, while you're at it, cross genetic modification off the list to save the planet. According to an article by Andrew Fox in The Independent, the UK newspaper, the results from the largest study ever done on GM foods are in. The so-called miracle plants actually produce less food than older conventional varieties. In one test in Kansas, a field planted with Monsanto genetically modified soybeans actually produced 10% less food. Another study by the University of Nebraska found similar results. As Andrew Fox wrote, quote, Professor Bob Watson, the director of the study and chief scientist at the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, when asked if GM could solve world food hunger, said, the simple answer is no. Find that article at the Independent newspaper. All right, let's get to a story that wasn't expected for another decade or more. The ugly future is not just coming, it has arrived. Rice traders are panicking all over Asia and the Middle East. Prices of staple grains like rice, soybeans, wheat, and corn have doubled or worse. There have been food riots in at least 10 countries. Hungry stomachs are angry, and various authorities and pundits in the West are already warning of political destabilization in developing countries due to hunger. This security threat is so real, even the U.S. Air Force is calling for an Apollo-type program to stop global warming. As reported in the Guardian newspaper on April 28th, the Air Force is trying to form a consortium from governments, universities, companies, and even environmental groups to find answers before climate change goes out of control. The U.S. Air Force and the French Air Force have already met to find ways to reduce their climate footprint. Well, maybe not so many bombing missions or something. There are heartbreaking stories of the working poor. One woman in Egypt complained that despite rock-bottom wages, she had always managed to buy the basics to feed her family. Now, on the same pay, she was forced to give up cooking oil, and the family was reduced to one skimpy meal a day. Her husband is outraged. Multiply that times a billion, and you get the picture. Soaring oil prices are part of the picture, of course. You and I may be involved. All the deferred consumption of the baby boomers is built up in zillions of dollars of pensions and investment funds. This wave of money is scrambling to find a safe place to land now that the U.S. dollar is crashing. A lot of big funds are buying future rights to oil, wheat, and other commodities. Even if the buck is useless, people will always want food and oil. That speculation pushes up the commodity prices, as you know. The gas pumps and the groceries prices, well, they tell the story. It's a weird feedback effect in play now. The European Commission is so concerned they are waffling on the previous plan to replace 10% of all gas and diesel fuels with biofuel by 2020. Various national governments are re-examining their policy. We'll see what happens. Meanwhile, French President Nicolas Sarkozy told a meeting of top ministers from 16 countries that climate change could impact food and fishing resources severely. He said, quote, "Climate change is already having a considerable impact on security." Sarkozy referenced the climate factor in Darfur and the recent drought-stricken reductions in the Australian wheat exports. Sarkozy predicted that climate change will drive a wave of immigrants toward the developed world in search of food. That's hardly a future event. Whether you are in Europe, America, or Russia, the southern border is already leaking, with millions of people looking for steady meals and reliable energy. The future of climate immigrants is already here. Humans add at least 70 million new mouths to feed each year. Meanwhile, a minority of the world population goes from fat to morbidly obese. And all the new middle class of China and India want to join the meat eaters club. Can this go well?
Amazing facts.
Every year, the human race burns the equivalent of 400 years worth of total planetary vegetation in the condensed form of fossil fuels. That comes from Christopher Calder, who calculates biofuels will, quote, significantly contribute to the early, avoidable deaths of, at a minimum, between 10 and 20 million people worldwide in the year 2008, end quote. Calder bases that on a conservative estimate based on the United Nations statistics. He says as many as 30 million people in Bangladesh are going hungry right now while you are listening. Burning food for big pickup trucks and NASCAR races is negligent homicide. So I guess it's good news that General Motors is laying off 3,500 workers at four plants that produce trucks and SUVs. GM announced it will make 88,000 fewer pickups and 50,000 fewer large SUVs in 2008. Yippee! Let's get back to the climate. Scientists at NOAA's Earth System Research Lab reported that despite all the talk and meetings, greenhouse gases are rising faster than ever before. Carbon dioxide rose 2.4 parts per million last year to hit 385 parts per million, compared to CO2 levels of 280 parts per million before the industrial age. Worse, methane emissions are way up. Now, this is strange news, considering that methane seems to have stabilized for several years. It is one of the most powerful greenhouse gases, 25 times more powerful than CO2 in trapping the sun's energy here on Earth. According to scientist Ed Lukokenki, reported by the Associated Press, quote, methane in the atmosphere rose by 27 million tons last year, after nearly a decade with little or no increase. End quote. Scientists think the new burst of methane is coming from the rapid industrialization in Asia, plus wetland emissions in the newly thawing Arctic. We thought this might happen, and here it comes. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reports, quote, last month was the warmest March on record over land surfaces of the world and the second warmest overall worldwide. Overall, land and sea surface temperatures for the world were second highest in 129 years of record-keeping, trailing only 2002. It didn't seem all that warm for us here on the West Coast, as the cool Pacific currents called La Niña swept in frigid air. But it isn't what happens in your backyard, but around the world that matters, and both the satellite and the land measuring stations total up the warmest March on record. Well, second warmest, right here in 2008. Finally, right up there as a contender for the scariest story of the week. The jet stream is definitely moving toward the pole in the Northern Hemisphere. Seth Borenstein, one of the premier science reporters for Associated Press, quotes a new study co-authored by Ken Caldera, saying, basically, look south of where you are, and that's probably a good guess of what your weather might be like in a few decades, end quote. The paper in the journal Geophysical Research Letters finds that between 1979 and 2001, the jet stream in the Northern Hemisphere moved north at an average rate of 1.25 miles a year. Caldera says, quote, it doesn't sound like much, but that works out to about 18 feet a day. If you think about the climate zone shifting northward at this rate, you can imagine squirrels keeping up. But what are the oak trees going to do? We're seeing a general northward shift of all sorts of phenomenon in the northern hemisphere occurring at rates that are faster than what ecosystems can keep up with, end quote. Another researcher, Deanne Seidel at NOAA, found a much faster expansion of the tropical belt. In the southern hemisphere, there are two jet streams, both of which are moving towards their pole in the Antarctic. This may be responsible for the long-lasting drought in Australia. All of the wind shifts were predicted by models of climate change, but scientists are just beginning to measure those effects in the real world. All the proof is not yet in, but we do know this. These currents of air in the upper atmosphere determine a lot of our weather, steer the big storms, and dominate where crops will grow and where deserts form. Oh my, let's take a break with a song by David Rovics, songmeister for the movement. Grab a whole dose of his music free at davidrovics.com, spelled R-O-V-I-C-S, and look for his performances wherever he comes. He's really worth listening to. This one is called Here at the End of the World.
Standing here on a highway turned into a lake, born on this planet that I didn't make. The ice caps are melting, you can measure the rise of the poisoned oceans, hear all the lies of the political pundits and corporate crooks, their accountants and scientists cooking the books with hardly an inkling of what it's about. Wedded to profit in flood and in drought, I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world. Standing here on the bayou amidst mountains of soil, washed up farmland covered in oil. 1 ton every acre, lost every year, and along with the pesticides, it ends up right here. Millions of miles of chemical wheat, challenging all to try to compete and lay waste to your country like we've done to ours. Let them eat coffee, sugar, coca, and flowers. I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world. Here in the city, shrouded in smoke, 10 million people this morning awoke to a future of cancer, industrial disease. So let's build some more suburbs and buy SUVs, cut down the mountains, burn all the coal, and put all the money in a humongous bowl. They'll call it progress and they'll blame it on you to end life as we know it, to enrich the few. I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world. Yes, I speak to you now from an occupied place. You might call it your home or a terrorist base. They'll send your sons and your daughters to make sure that it's theirs, while they sit in their mansions in plush leather chairs. And everyone's waiting for us to decide. In dust we were born, and in dust we reside. Will we realize the commons is to shepherd and share? Here in this war zone called land, water, and air, I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world. I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world.
Back on Earth, the human financial systems are also churning, unfortunately. And it's hitting home in more ways than one. There were twice as many American homes going into foreclosure in the first quarter of 2008 than in the same period of the previous year. That's about 650,000 homes heading for bank auction. Up to 2 million American families will run away from their high mortgages and failing property values or get kicked out. California is by far the hardest hit by this cycle of foreclosures.
In fact, the homeless population in California is estimated at 360,000, including 95,000 children, making it the highest in the nation. And there's a growing trend in California cities to ban overnight parking, which targets the homeless people living in their cars. But in Santa Barbara, where there's an estimated 4,000 homeless, the city's tough no parking ordinance has given way to a creative new solution, the only one of its kind in the state. And it seems to be working for the homeless and for the city.
Is it just coincidence that Santa Barbara has finally given up trying to move along all the working poor and disabled people living in their cars? California, with its fine climate, is also the leading nation in the new phenomenon, the mobile homeless.
Anybody that lives in their vehicle can come to me and get a permit to use our safe nightly parking spots around town. We park people at night between 7 p.m. and 7 a.m., and problem solved. The beauty of this program is that these parking lots are empty at night. No one's using them. We're not encouraging people to sleep in their vehicles, but the fact is people sleep in their vehicles, and we have to deal with that.
But it's all over the nation. We hear about the ones who make it out, like the pop star Jewel and American Idol contestant Josiah Lemming. 18-year-old Josiah Lemming was living in his car in Tennessee when he tried out for American Idol. Now he's sold about $40,000 worth of music over the net since getting kicked off Idol, but appearing on The Ellen Show. Jewel says she was living in a tiny Datsun 510 hatchback. When that was stolen, she borrowed enough to buy a Volkswagen van. When Jewel went homeless, she was working as a waitress and scraping leftover food off patrons' plates. Unable to make the rent, she lived in her car. Nobody knows how many people live in their cars in many countries. They are the invisible poor and hope to stay invisible. Cops move them on, and the cost of parking tickets can be high. Some cities have harsh fines and even jail terms for sleeping in your car. Even the official counts of the homeless do not include this unreported minority, who are surely growing as the economy weakens. It can happen to anyone. One dot-com CEO, a multimillionaire on paper before the bust, ended up in his converted school bus with two sons. Many lost their jobs or relationships or had other personal problems. It is startling to discover the number of car people who still work at low-wage burger joints or part-time at Walmart. They just don't earn enough to pay the rent in the region where they work. According to a study done by the National Low Income Housing Coalition, last year was the first time on record that a worker earning minimum wage would not be able to afford a one-bedroom apartment at the average going rate anywhere in the country. Hurricane Katrina added to the mobile homeless, sometimes called the half-homeless. People lost their homes and had to flee quickly, and the car became the place to live. This could happen, even temporarily, to anyone. Struck by a storm, an earthquake, a terrorist attack, or just the next round of company layoffs. Are you ready? Here are Uncle Al's tips to be prepared, living in your car.
I see senior citizens, I see women, I see families. Especially the women and senior citizens, they don't deserve to live in their vehicles. It just really hurts me.
Step one, if you have any choice, pick a vehicle that allows you to sleep comfortably. Old station wagons are good, camper vans are better, but a lot of cars have back seats that fold flat and even trunk access from inside the car. Add a roll-up foamy for the bed. Of course, if two or three people are sharing the car, then it's lean back the front seats and somebody curls up in the back. It is possible to remove the front passenger seat and put in a plywood platform from the back to the front on the passenger side if you are a car-bound loner. But that really tips off the cops and nosy neighbors who want to complain about you.
I was a part of society, and I did have a life, and I did have a home. I did have a cat.
Step two, live better electrically. In order to have lights, operate a coffee grinder, a CD player, or even a computer in your car, you need to learn about batteries. Listeners who ever intend to install low-cost solar setups should also pay attention now. These are the facts of car battery life. The ordinary car battery is not designed to store large amounts of power. It is made to produce a lot of juice for a short time to start the car. After that, the engine powers the electric system. These car batteries are also fragile when it comes to being drained down. If you drain the battery to nothing, say by leaving the headlights on for 20 hours, the battery is weaker than it was before. Drain it just three or four times, and that battery is dead. Of course, if you are depending on the battery to start your vehicle, you don't want it to go right to the bottom. And who knows how much is left, so you are afraid to use what you have. The answer is to install a second battery and a different kind of battery. This assumes you can scrounge about $150 sometime or have a mechanic friend. Most cars and trucks have room under the hood for a second battery. A local garage can mount a second battery box for a fairly small fee. They should also install a device that is found in all RVs. These recreational vehicles have at least two batteries, and there is a switch, usually installed on the firewall, that allows the engine to charge the second battery. The switch also prevents the main battery from ever being drawn down. That is, when you plug in your 12-volt coffee grinder into the cigarette lighter, the power will come from the second battery only. No matter how long you leave on your little electric lights inside the car, the main battery will never be used. It will be strong to start the car. We can all make do with the battery that we find used at a garage, but the second battery should ideally be a deep discharge type, also called a marine battery. These can be drawn down near dead more than 24 times and survive, and they are designed to store lots of power to be released slowly over time instead of one big burst to push the starter motor on your car. There are all kinds of funky little appliances available now in 12-volt, ready to plug into your cigarette lighter. You can even get an extension cord with several 12-volt plugs to run several items at a time.
More people are living in their vehicles out here than anybody's even thought about since Steinbeck wrote Grapes of Wrath.
Car batteries give off bad chemicals, which can very occasionally explode, so you can't put a second battery inside the car where you live. If there isn't room under the hood, you might get one in the trunk, mounted in an airtight battery box, these plastic things, they don't cost too much, which has a vent drilled down through the floor to the outside. I have done that. You might have to get a mechanic do it for you. The point is, batteries need air that you aren't breathing. Oh yeah, and a battery that never needs maintenance is the best kind, the kind where you can't lift the little lids to see the fluid. Those old ones just spill when you go around the corners. The mobile homeless even have their own stand-up comic. Here's Daryl Bedford, who's living in his car in Alberta, Canada.
So my vehicular unit has to double as my residential quarters. That doesn't make me any different than you guys. Like, for instance, you have problems, like you'd complain about rent and mortgage. Well, I have to pay parking, right? And the high price of gas affects me just as much as it does you. In fact, maybe even a little bit more so, because now that octane is so pricey, most people only keep their tanks like a quarter full, which means I've got to spend more time going around at night siphoning gas.
Well, step three, if you are still getting some kind of income while living in your car, the next step is to save up for a cheap solar panel to put on the roof. The harsh truth about battery charging is this. You can never recharge a battery just by idling the motor. Even if you sit in the driver's seat with your foot on the gas pedal, revving like hell, your battery barely gets a charge. Trust me, I've tried it. It doesn't work. It doesn't recharge the battery enough to light up a mouse's flashlight. The only real way to recharge your battery with the car or van is to drive it. Like 50 miles or so, highway driving works best. That puts a load on your generator or alternator and you get the juice. But at today's gas prices, who can afford that, and it's bad for the climate? It would be cheaper to take the battery to a local garage and get them to recharge it overnight for you. But a small solar panel will recharge the battery every day, even on cloudy days. The size of panel you need depends on how far north you live and how much power you use. A 50-watt panel is expensive, but really works. Even a cheapo 15-watt panel should keep up if you scrimp on your power use. Go solar as soon as you can.
And the automobile, it can get quite chilly while I'm slumbering, you know. Luckily, it's been a mild winter. Thank you, SUV drivers. I appreciate it. The global warming keeps me toasty. Yes, it does. You guys like me, you see a guy in a big SUV drive by, and you say to yourself, now there's a guy with a nice crib.
Step four, well, windows are the key to keeping warm enough or cool enough. They're also a security concern. Let's picture summer. You want the windows open to get air. Unless you are the meanest mother on the block, you probably want the windows just partway down to keep people from reaching into your home while you sleep. But anyone can reach in to lift the door locks and then be on you before you really wake up. The solution, which I have used for years, is to buy four cheap sliding deadbolts at the hardware store. Get or borrow an electric drill and install these sliders way down low on each door, hopefully where they are difficult to see, and yet you can reach them quickly from the inside. Slide these extra locks closed at night. Then when that attic thief or creep tries to reach in and open the door, they're frustrated to find it is still locked. By that time, you have time to react. I've used these inside door locks at the sketchy overnight rest stops, just like the one outside of L.A. And incidentally, if you think those windows are going to protect you, people can smash them in, so it's handy to have those door locks installed. The best option is to always have your keys handy, always know where your keys are, get them into the ignition, and drive away. That is why you always sleep with enough clothes on to legally drive, or at least to talk to the cop who wants to move you on. I say, when sleeping in a vehicle, never put the club, you know, those security clubs, on the steering wheel. You want to be able to drive away quickly. Of course, you can call 911 on a cell phone if you still have one, and at worst, you can always have either the club itself or a handy hammer to discourage the invader from reaching in again, because your doors are still locked. Sorry to talk about all that, but security is a big concern for people living or camping in cars or vans. The very best solution is to travel with a largish dog, but only if you have enough money to feed your friend and pay the occasional vet bill. And the dog has to go wherever you go, because you can never leave it in a hot vehicle. Step 5 is getting back to that hot and cold thing. If you have a second battery, you can buy some really neat 12-volt fans to save you from the hottest day or night. You can even mount a couple in the window cracks. It is possible to have a 12-volt food cooler, but shop carefully as some are energy hogs. You have to open up the box right in the store and read the owner's manual to find out how many amps per hour it draws. The formula for electricity is simple. Volts, the level of electricity, times the amperage, the flow of electricity, equals watts, the total electricity used. So a 12-volt cooler, which draws 4 amps per hour, is about 50 watts, 4 times 12. A cooler drawing 4 amps can only be run a few hours a day at most, likely at the hottest part of the day. Usually these things work better with some ice cubes added to help them out if you can. Most car dwellers learn to live without things that need to be kept cold. Powdered milk instead of liquid milk in a cooler, for example. When it comes to keeping warm at night, the windows are your biggest problem. Car windows just leak heat out and let cold in right away, even when they're closed. You can keep a little warmer by hanging clothes over the windows or even making puffy insulated curtains for them. It makes a huge difference. The real secret to keeping warm in a vehicle is not to heat the car, but to use your own heat to keep warm. That means sleeping in several layers of clothes and wearing a toque or hat, because most of your heat leaks out through your head. Thermo-reflecting blankets, those silvery things that fold up quite small, work well too. Every car should have 2 or 3 of these thermal blankets just for emergencies. They can save lives. Well, here's a few final tips. Don't forget, if you are still working or hope to get a job, you don't want to stink. Camping stores sell a black rubber bag which heats up water in the sun. They come with a shower attachment, which you can use hanging from a tree or even discreetly in a back alley. Get a propane cook stove when you can to heat up water for sponge baths as well as meals. You cannot use any propane appliance inside your car, ever. Cooking can be on the tailgate, a picnic bench, anywhere outside. People trying to use propane stoves as a heater to keep warm routinely die of carbon monoxide poisoning, outside only for propane. Of course, your car should not look too neat or inviting to thieves. If you leave it during the day, stash as much as you can out of sight, and maybe toss in a few newspapers and smelly socks to disinvite visitors. Yet it shouldn't look so run down that the cops arrive. It's a fine balance. Living in a vehicle can save tons of money, especially when visiting expensive cities. Car homes are also a good fallback for public emergencies like terror attacks, storms or earthquakes, or even just a fire in your own home. With a few arrangements, you can be comfortable for a while. Good luck and bon voyage. Some voices of the homeless are taken from a video called Half Homeless from CaliforniaConnected.org, produced by Angela Shelley. This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. Nick Rosen is Britain's leading expert in off-grid living. He is editor of www.off-grid.net. His book, How to Live Off-Grid, is published by Doubleday and in the UK. He says it's not about survivalism, but about getting by when economic times are tough. Well, now Rosen's site is being deluged by Americans who have lost their homes or fear they will. What was a lifestyle choice for many eco-conscious people may just become a necessity for many more. So, Nick, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, for those of us who take endless energy for granted, what is off-grid living?
Well, on a literal level, it's about living without mains energy, without mains power and mains water and sewage and, you know, all those services that we come to expect and depend upon in our busy modern lives. It also has a metaphorical meaning, which is about freedom, about just disconnecting and unplugging in the kind of mental or emotional sense, and just finding your own space, which isn't part of the system.
Yes, I suppose. Well, now, how does that compare with, say, someone who is homeless and traveling about the country?
Well, you know, there's kind of layer of people who've been homeless for a long time, and that's kind of a life they've chosen or stumbled into, and then there's a kind of new class of homeless who, until very recently, own their homes. And everybody is truly homeless. Yeah, they're off-grid. But there is a way of being off-grid in comfort and luxury and, you know, making it a positive choice rather than in any way a kind of sense of deprivation. And that's the meaning I'm concentrating on. So people who feel they've lost everything because they've had their homes foreclosed and repossessed, as is happening all across the United States at the moment, are getting in touch and looking for advice on how to live in RVs or cars, or build a cabin on a back lot that maybe they've, you know, hung on to through the bad times, or talking about going out and buying a couple of acres in East Texas and building some kind of a shanty on it. And, you know, it's happening. It's a real phenomenon.
Well, you know, I hate to tell you, but I think I've done most of those. I did build a cabin off on some land and lived without electricity for many years, and I've also lived in an RV with a solar panel up on the rooftop, and they were some of the best years of my life, definitely in touch with nature, with the sky, with the times, and the people around me. So I it's not necessarily suffering, is it?
It sure isn't, and I don't know when you did that, but in the last few years, it really has become, you know, high-tech and, you know, highly comfortable. Just about every gadget that you can imagine now has a low-energy mobile variety that you can plug into a car cigar lighter. And, you know, since the arrival of the Internet, you can now work and make a living if you're a knowledge worker just about anywhere. So the idea that you might be kind of trapped or stuck in the wild somewhere just isn't true anymore. I kind of came across this whole phenomenon when I bought a very modest little shepherd's hut up in the mountains in Spain. And I did it just for my sanity because I wanted somewhere to just unplug. And a few years later, I discovered that it was something, you know, that what I was doing was living off-grid. And then the Internet came along and I was able to be a journalist, which is what I do for a living, up in my mountain, which was great. So you could be there and not there at the same time. You know, you could plug and unplug at will.
Well, could you tell us a little bit about the off-grid scene in the UK?
Yeah, it's less developed than in North America. It's a combination of a bunch of different kinds of phenomena. There's the 70s hippie movement. There's the 80s and 90s anti-roads protesters, who are a really major social phenomenon here. They were there were some people called the New Age Gypsies, which was a huge convoy of people who lived in vans, and they got taken apart by the right-wing Tory governments in the 80s and scattered to the four winds. But they've slowly reformed and came back as campaigners against the big motorway building program, and kind of lay down in front of the motorways and hid in trees and stopped the building from taking place. Anyway, that group, that kind of ideological group, has been at the forefront of fighting for the right to live off-grid in Britain. And along with them, there's also people who can't afford a home at a time when houses in Britain cost something like 6 to 8 times average annual income. So, you know, house prices, you may think they're sky-high where you are, but over here, it's virtually impossible for people to get onto the housing ladder without a huge chunk of money, usually from their parents. So that's the second category, people who just cannot afford to buy a place and don't want to spend $300 to $500 a week, you know, sharing an apartment with somebody who steals their milk from the fridge. So there's those two categories. Then there's a kind of your middle class green liberal who is doing it for softer ideological reasons, you know, part of society rather than the Rhodes protesters who are really kind of anarchists. And finally, you know, there's a very luxurious level of off-grid living. We people I came across when I drove around Britain just looking and meeting and finding out how it was done. There's people who build luxury homes off-grid, and the same kind of phenomenon is true in America, except there's just lots more of them, and I'm hoping very much to come over and start meeting you guys as well.
Well, what kind of stories are you hearing from Americans now? I know your website's getting pretty busy as the economy tumbles and as people are going through foreclosures.
Yeah, they range hugely in terms of the people who've actually lost their homes. They range from a single guy who lost his job, lost his house, and is now sleeping in his car. You know, he's managed to get employment, but he doesn't see why he should, you know, waste his money on another home. He's kind of happy in his car, really. He's worked out where he can overnight without any interaction with the law enforcement authorities. To a family who had a really luxurious life until the breadwinner in the family lost his main client. I think it was a design company. And all of a sudden, they found their high spending ways got them into trouble. They missed the mortgage payments. They lost the home. But they had a little back lot they bought when times were good, like 10 acres. And they've described in great detail on the website exactly how they changed their life. They went there in an RV. They bought $500 worth of stuff from the hardware store and just set about rebuilding their lives and have done so. There's the Dervais family from Pasadena who have been living off-grid for a few years now in a suburb. What's interesting about them is they're not out in some rural outback. They're right on the edge of town in Pasadena. All sorts, really.
I'm picturing some of these unfortunate people as pioneers of a sort because Americans have been, well, just too luxurious with their use of energy. Maybe, do you think some new products and markets might lead us to become more economical with energy, with much lower expectations, just because of the developments that these people will make?
Yeah, I think that it's pretty miserable, you know, what's happening at the moment. But the positive side, the silver lining, is that maybe they are showing us the way to the future. At a time when, you know, energy prices are skyrocketing, food prices are now skyrocketing, I think that we might be entering a really long-term period of leaner times. And I don't mean some kind of disaster or chaos or catastrophe, but just a recognition that the rest of the world is catching up with us. And, you know, we're not entitled to cheap energy for the rest of eternity. So it's kind of like a coming to terms with the reality of the planet and finding that it really ain't that bad. That, you know, perhaps you could think of it as small is the new big, you know, a smaller home, a smaller car, you know, maybe eat less, and maybe that's a good thing, and we'll all come out of it as better people.
Could you give us 3 good tips, perhaps, for our listeners of what to do when the power goes out or if you want to live off-grid? What sorts of things might they find in your book?
Well, Hard to know where to start, really. One idea is maybe just get yourself a little bit off-grid ready. There's a great book by Canadian Thomas Homer Dixon called The Upside of Down, in which he envisages a future which is perhaps, you know, perhaps a bit more bleak than the one I personally can envisage. And he talks about the need to be resilient as a society and on the individual household level. And so perhaps one thing you can do is to just get off-grid ready in your own home, which means, by which I do not mean having a stack of canned food in the basement. I just mean get a solar panel, get some really large receptacle for collecting rainwater and a battery for storing that energy from the solar panel. Perhaps take your spare room off-grid and just get a sense of what it's like. And what you'll find is that you start noticing the weather more and just being aware more of how much energy you're using and just naturally becoming a bit more economical. So maybe that's step one. And then step two is, I guess, I recommend people go camping, but not on a campsite. You know, get in the car, or jump on a train, take your camping gear, and just try and find somewhere that's a bit secluded and either get permission or try and get away with it without permission. And just camp out for a couple of days without the usual support systems of a campsite, and you'll find it's not that hard, and it really can be quite pleasant.
Well, now, you're leading me to a couple of questions about your book. The first one is, how can people get it? And the second is, are you going to come out with a North American edition?
Well, that's nice of you to ask. You can get it by my website, and you're welcome to order it from anywhere in the world, and I sign it and personally go down to the post office and put it in the post to you, and I try and keep the price as low as possible. I'm really hoping to come out and do a kind of North American equivalent and travel around Canada and the United States and meet people who are living off-grid and describe how they're doing it and how they're doing it lawfully, because there's all sorts of zoning restrictions and how to get around those issues, and just get a sense of what kind of community is living off-grid now in the States, and try and spread the word. I'm talking to a couple of publishers on the East Coast, and very much hoping that something will come of it.
And can you give us your website for people?
Sure, it's www.offgrid.net, off-grid.net.
Well, that's really great, Nick. I appreciate it. Nick, you are the man when it comes to expertise in living off the matrix. Thanks for talking with us today.
Very nice of you to have me on. Thank you.
You know, as Americans struggle to get by with millions in poverty amid the greatest riches, people are asking, how can the U.S. go into debt to fund foreign wars, and yet the government can't provide a health care system? Why are people living in cars while Halliburton and hedge fund boys rake in the billions? Anyone would think America could close some of its 800 military bases in over 100 countries abroad and spend that money at home. There is a worldwide movement to do just that. Google the words Code Pink and start looking around. One of my favorite old-time radio activists, Sue Supriano, has a good half-hour interview which includes Media Benjamin explaining how women founded Code Pink. They are dedicated to ending the American military empire abroad, the men's war games that are bleeding the country dry. Here's a clip starting with Medea Benjamin talking and a little bit from Sue.
People are often asking, why aren't Americans even concerned about their own self-interest? Their schools are crumbling. They don't have a health care system that's worth anything. They don't have an infrastructure that can even stop their cities like New Orleans from being destroyed, and they allow their government to keep funding war.
And what do you say?
I tell them all the things that we're trying to do. I try to explain some of the structural obstacles to building a more effective movement, and then I give them examples of the actions and the movements and the different ways that we're trying to change our government. And I think it's important for people to know that we're not just all sitting around twiddling our thumbs or waiting for the next election, that we are a significant number of people who are trying to organize and mobilize and inspire people to get involved. And I think another really interesting thing about what goes on in the United States is how disempowered people feel and how that leads to apathy and cynicism and depression. And so part of our work is to really lift people's spirits and let them know that activism is not only good for the country and good for the planet, it's good for their own personal health.
That is certainly true. And I'm focused actually on other issues of climate change and peak oil, since I can't do everything. But I'm just astounded by how people say they can't do anything. It's just like a mantra. I mean, it's just really... really upsetting. And of course you can always do something while you're until you're dead, really, and then maybe you can still do something, I don't know.
Okay, from the same Sue Supriano interview, Medea explains how Code Pink was founded and that men can be involved.
And I don't know if everybody knows what Code Pink is. I just think it's so well known now, I'm just taking it for granted, but maybe you would say a little bit about that.
Well, Code Pink began as a play on the color-coded alert system of the red and the orange and the yellow alerts, saying, you know, be scared, be very, very scared, and used to justify more violence against violence. And we started out really just kind of kidding around, saying, well, let's call a Code Pink alert and say, let's use international law, let's use the United Nations, let's find nonviolent ways of dealing with conflict. And it really just took off to the extent now that we have a very large mailing list and our e-alerts that we send out every week of 180,000 people. We have 250, more or less, local Code Pink groups around the U.S. and then in places around the world. And we've become the most visible, perhaps the pink helps, but the most visible anti-war groups, so much so that George Bush has mentioned us several times. The White House spokesperson talks about Code Pink quite a lot, and they try to paint us as this fringe, radical, crazy, anti-troop group, when really a lot of us are a bunch of mothers who are just absolutely disgusted with the way our country is going and determined to do something about it. But we also have a lot of young people. We have a lot of chapters on campuses, a lot of young women who like the playfulness of Code Pink, like the idea that we use street theater and song and dance and art. And so it's quite intergenerational. It's way too white, and we have been trying to find ways to bring more people of color. For example, at the Code Pink House last week, we had 18 girls from the Lower East Side of Manhattan who came, and we took them into Congress with the message of books not bombs, education not warfare, and they loved it. They had a great, great experience and are going back really jazzed up. So we try to make our house in Washington available to groups that have been focusing on domestic issues and help them make the link between the billions of dollars we're spending for war instead of spending money on things like education and healthcare.
Yeah, that's great. And you're referring to women, but I just heard you say it's not just a women's organization, so just to clarify.
Yeah, we really appreciate men joining in to Code Pink, because we tell them, look, it's initiated by women and it's led by women, but it's great to have men involved. And in fact, it's important for us to not be exclusively women, to show that we are welcoming of men. And a lot of the people that stay at the Code Pink House are men. We tend to put them in the basement, but it's actually kind of a nice basement. And they get up early in the morning with us and go trudging off to the Congress, and oftentimes throw the congressional people off a little bit. Sometimes they come wearing suits and, you know, look like they're part of the D.C. mafia. And then all of a sudden when they're in the hearing, they'll, you know, take off their suit, and there will be their Code Pink shirt underneath. And I don't know, we have a lot of great men involved in the group.
Well, and I hear over and over again, this is a time of women. Women need to be taking leadership, and this is, you know, these are gross generalizations. There's all kinds of great men, too.
As you'll see on the net, Code Pink has now popped up in almost every country where America has unwanted military bases, from Italy to the Philippines and beyond. You can hear the full interview for free just by going to SueSupriano.com. That is SueSupriano www.sarahbakewell.com. The show is called Steppin' Out of Babylon. Tune into that. Next week on Radio EcoShock, we'll hear from one of the great women activists of all time. That is the anti-nuclear activist and physician from Australia, Helen Caldicott. Her 1979 book, Nuclear Madness, stirred the world. Many of you know her through the film documentary, If You Love This Planet. In the new century, Helen returned to lambaste George Bush's militaristic dreams. The book was The New Nuclear Danger, George W. Bush's Military Industrial Complex, published in 2001, and it still required reading. In 2006, Caldicott published another crucial piece of the puzzle, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer to Global Warming or Anything Else. That's the title. Talking about nuclear weapons and reactors isn't very popular today. People don't want to hear about it. Perhaps we are waiting for the next reactor to blow before we'll wake up again to the real danger. Helen Caldicott isn't waiting. She has launched a new podcast and radio show called If You Love This Planet. Next week on Radio EcoShock, we're going to give over the whole program to Helen's first broadcast in this series. It's a shocking story of near meltdowns in American reactors and how the government fails to protect anyone but the industry itself. We're all downwind of this story, as Chernobyl taught us. As far as I know, our broadcast next week will be the first time Helen Caldicott's new program has been heard by a syndicated audience anywhere in the world. An EcoShock premiere next week as Helen Caldicott exposes the continuing nuclear nightmare, just in time to head off the new reactor fever around the world, the fearful renaissance of the nuclear death industry. Don't miss Helen Caldicott, If You Love This Planet, the radio show, next week on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and thanks for listening. Let's go out with more woman power, The Sea Lion Woman, by the new Canadian power artist, Feist.
Sea Lion.
Take care.
cheese, she loves the rooster crows, she loves sit down, she loves, she drink up, she loves, she drink tea, she loves the rooster crows, she loves sit down, bam, dressed in blue, call on the man, and he knows what he can.